Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner Podcast with me, Chris Stanmore Major. Now, in this episode, I want to start having a look at a new segment, which I think we can start to get some real discussion going. I know when I say to you guys, hey, send me your questions, send me your ideas, I always get them. They're fantastic, but it's a little bit of a broad range, like send me any question or any statement you'd like to make about sailing. So let's narrow it down a little bit, and we're going to start looking at what makes the perfect boat, and I mean in the 30-foot to 40-foot range. It's that kind of a couple want to buy a boat and sail around the world with or without a small family, with or without another couple, that kind of like small grouping of people together, out for adventure, out to travel. What makes the perfect boat there? Now, for me, the kind of boats I work on, 60-foot to 80-foot, something like that, but they are uncompromising designs which are specifically brought into existence to hit one particular nail squarely on the head, and that's racing as fast as you can around the world, either solo or with a crew, hopefully to bring back the silverware. But the thing with cruising boats is that they have so many requirements on them, and there's so many different ways of doing the same thing. You might want to cruise in the Caribbean, you might want to cruise in high latitudes, you might want to cross oceans a lot or go up into narrow creeks. What are the kind of boats that people are selecting as their perfect boat? Can we start to draw any particular themes out of them? And of course, what can we learn from other people's perspective on this most important question? So what we're going to do today is we're going to start off with the piece of reading which I did. I've got this other podcast, which I'm always going on about, sorry, the Mariner's Library. It's really inspiring for me because I get to read these old sailing books and I learn so much from it. And I hear these wonderful voices coming through of these sailors who are now long since dead. All these books are like 100 years old. And yet in their words, there's things which we can find benefit in, right? So if that's true, then their ideas about what makes the perfect boat should still be relevant today, if indeed I am correct when I say that what went 100 years ago in sailing still has some usefulness to people today, the entire concept of the Mariner's Library podcast. So I've got a reading here, which is from a book I picked up called The Track of the Typhoon. It was written in 1921, and it's an absolutely fantastic read, both from the point of view of the adventure and the travel which is in it, and also from the technical aspects. It's written by a guy called William Washburn Nutting, who was a writer for Motorboat and Yachting magazine at that time. So aficionado of sailing, and he seems to be like friends with Alexander Bell and all these different yacht designers. So he's, you know, eyes wide open going into the design process. And I read this second chapter, the second part of the book. This book, actually, I do the Mariner's Library, which has lots and lots of different books, but then I specifically put some of the books into Patreon, and their Patreon supporters can listen to them exclusively there. So I don't have a sponsor for this. For this podcast, there's no like extra money flitting in any which way. So I'm going to sponsor myself here by saying, if you want to have a look at the Mariner's Library, this book is very akin to what's going on there. But if you want to put that $5 a month in to help support this podcast, The Mariner, that podcast, The Mariner's Library, and The Mariner YouTube channel, then you'll be able to hear the rest of this book. And I think it's worth listening to. But even if you don't listen to the rest of it, we'll get into the discussion with as many people as we can as to what makes the best 30 to 40 foot boat. And I've already lined up the first interview, and it's going to be with John Harries, who, of course, along with his wife Phyllis, are the people which own and operate the Attainable Adventure Cruising website. You can find them easily at morganscloud.com. That site is a fantastic place to go and get really nitty gritty details on sailing, the kind of detail I know some of you absolutely love, but also mixed into that stories of their travels and exploits in high latitudes, sailing on their own 50-foot their boat, and attaining the kind of adventure cruising that we all dream of, hence the name of their website, right? So Attainable Adventure Cruising at morganscloud.com. And if any of you that know about Bermuda will recognize the connection there with Morgan's Cloud, John, of course, being from Bermuda. And I'm going to interview him. He and the people on his website, like 200,000 plus people interested in sailing and the nitty-gritty of sailing, got together over a number of years through the website and designed a boat which ended up being called the Adventure 40. Now, there's a few false starts with getting it fully designed and built, but that seems to be underway now. And I'm going to have a chat to John and find out what he and his cohorts and his website have distilled as being the best 40-foot boat that they can. Their brief was a particular budget. I think it was $250,000 US for two people, and it was high latitudes cruising. The piece of reading which I'm going to give you today from William Nutting's book. I get confused with his name. William Washburn Nutting. That's a wonderful, feels like a 1920s name. Hello, this is William Washburn Nutting. His boat is very different. His whole adventure is based around the fact that he kind of last minute decides that this long dreamed of boat that he's been thinking of, are going to get it built, and then they're going to scoot across the Atlantic as fast as they can and enter this race. It's the Harmsworth Trophy Races in Cowes. And they end up being delayed by the builder, well, surprise, surprise, and having to rush across. But from what I've read from just scanning ahead a little bit, do indeed manage to get there. So 1922, crossing the Atlantic. I think I wrote in one of the initial write-ups about this book on my Patreon site that it in 1922, the prospect of going and doing that, I think Slocum had only sailed around the world like and come back and published about it 20 years before. The idea of just nipping across the Atlantic on a 30 or 40 foot boat is completely unheard of. On the Mariner's Library, there's another book there called Strange But True, which is Thomas Crapo and his wife going across the Atlantic in a dory. This, people were just minds completely blown that you could just do this in a small boat. And of course, nothing to come and help you and save you, or certainly nothing you can initiate yourself unless someone comes and helps you. So the rapidity with which they get ready for this and go and do it, I think I said on my podcast, on my Patreon feed, that it was akin to deciding that next week you're going to cycle across America to enter a road race that you're like kind of interested in. He kind of wanted to do this cows race. He's like, hey, let's race across the Atlantic to go and do it. So a little bit madcap, but the description that he came up with in this section of the book that I'm going to present to you here, I think captures a lot of the joy and the kind of excitement of designing a new boat, all of the interesting convoluted kind of machinations which go together when you're designing a new boat. And you might hear some of the author's voice coming through. It's an excellent book. I've already read most of it, and say that's going over onto patreon.com/themariner. And he's just got a wonderful voice that I feel is just as fresh as it ever was. So without any further ado, let me present to you a section here of The Track of the Typhoon by William Washburn Nutting. I find this kind of, I love old books like this, and it's so great to jump into them and then realize that, yeah, this was published in 1921, 101 years ago. This could be written literally last week about anybody's trying to build a boat. So William Washburn Nutting and The Track of the Typhoon. I'll jump back in at the end for a little bit just to give you a heads up as to where to go next if you want to hear the rest of this book. Here we go, The Track of the Typhoon. Chapter 1, Continued. Everyone knows the ancient arguments pro and con the various types of rig, the advantages and disadvantages of the schooner, the yawl, sloop, and ketch, and while many would prefer the schooner or yawl rig for a 45-foot auxiliary, we have chosen the ketch. We feel that the various combinations of sail permitted by a ketch and the shorter main boom make it more desirable for our purpose than either a yawl or a schooner, even at a slight loss of speed. This is largely theoretical, for our experience with the rig is not great, and we may be wrong. The total area of the three sails is about 950 square feet. There was a lot of discussion about the headsails. First, Aitken drew in a jib and forestaysail because the size of a single jib terrified us. We felt that it would give us greater sail combinations for bad weather and would allow us to tack our forestay down to the stemhead. Then Casey took the floor on behalf of the single jib and reminded me that Elsie's jib gave us no trouble when we had sailed her short-handed. Then I remembered the heartbreaking job of casting off and belaying two sets of headsail sheets on the old Neris every time I came about, and while this could have been simplified by sheeting the forestaysail to a traveller, the impression was so vivid that I yielded without a struggle to the single jib. There is no question as to its greater efficiency, And with such a bowsprit as we have indicated, the added security of a forestay to the stem head is of little consequence. Possibly the thoroughgoing motor boatman by this time may be a bit fed up with this lengthy discussion of Typhoon's lines and rig to the exclusion of her power plant. We ask his indulgence and wish to explain that Typhoon makes no pretense of being a motorboat. She is an auxiliary, and an auxiliary of the only type that is worth bothering with. That is, a boat that can take care of herself on any point of sailing, except possibly in light airs, when her motor will be depended on to drive her. And may I be permitted to voice the opinion that a little sailboat dope administered in mild doses will do no harm to those of the motorboat fraternity who have arrived without the experience of the windjammer. Now let's look at the deck arrangement. You will see that we have played for simplicity, with as few openings as possible. The cabin trunk, 6 feet in width, is rectangular, leaving broad decks on either side, and the sides of the trunk extend aft to form the combing for the bridge deck and cockpit, making an unbroken construction with nothing to stop green water in its passage along the waterways. I have always liked a bridge deck on a seaboat. It strengthens the boat by permitting continuous deck beams, it gives a lot of room above the motor space, and is even more useful as a seat or table than equivalent space in the cockpit would be. The self-bailing well is 6 feet square, and we have left it open without side seats so that we can get down in the lee of the combing out of the wind. The deck fore and aft of it will be used for seats, and because of the depth of the well, two little corner seats are indicated, which may be used either as seats or as footrests when seated on the after deck. They occupy the corners only so as not to interfere with anyone standing at the wheel. The mizzenmast is supported by a king plank extending from the bridge deck and flanked by natural crook knees to take the side thrust. It steps in a bronze socket in the cockpit floor, and the step is supported by a stanchion to the keel. To prevent water taken over the stern or running aft from coming back into the cockpit due to the lift of the sheer at the stern, a combing has been placed across the deck, and in the angle formed by this and the side combings, the quarter bits are placed. Eventually, we shall want some sort of hatch or skylight in the cabin trunk, but since we should have to keep it battened down on the cruise across the Atlantic, we have decided to leave the cabin top unbroken for the present except for the companionway. We are using swing ports, the kind with the collar in the forward and after ends of the trunk, and oval deadlights with brass frames in the sides. The glass for these, as well as for the deadlights in the hatch covers, is laminated, non-shatterable triplex. It is half an inch in thickness, and even if cracked by a flying block or the fluke of an anchor, it will remain watertight. We have spared no pains in the matter of the standing and running rigging. Harry Greening made up the galvanized plough steel wire for our shrouds and stays, especially for us in his wireworks at Hamilton, Ontario. And with this, we are using bronze turnbuckles and bronze outside chain plates. The turnbuckles are of the type with the Tobin bronze screw in the middle and were made by Merriman Brothers of Boston, the master hands when it comes to such fittings. Merriman also made our blocks. They are of lignum vitae and bronze, with bronze roller sheaves, and I'll stack them up with anything obtainable on either side of the Atlantic. For our running rigging, I went to the Colombian Rope Company. We already had had some experience with the fine white bolt rope put out by this concern, and we are using it on the Typhoon for everything from signal halyards to sea anchor cable. Besides the running rigging, sheets, lazy jacks and lifts, for which we are using sizes from 3/8 to 5-inch diameter, we are carrying 75 fathoms of 1-inch manila for towing, warping, etc., and for use with the drogue. All of it is 3-strand in preference to 4-strand. It handles better and I think lasts longer because the inside has a better chance to dry out. Our anchors are of the regular kedge type with the sliding stock, the big one 100 pounds in weight and the regular service one 60 pounds. The chain for these was made for us by the American Chain Company. It is 3/8 galvanized and the 75 fathoms we are using weighs 720 pounds. We are using some of this chain for the bobstay with a 7/8 bronze turnbuckle, as this stay is the keystone of the whole rig, especially on a boat without a forestay tacked down to the stemhead. In her interior arrangement, Typhoon is more radical than in her lines, and for this I must plead guilty. I have never liked to see a boat cut up into 6.5-foot compartments, and I decided long ago that mine at least wasn't going to be that way. Jack Hanna once said, and he hit the nail on the finger that time, that until a generation or so ago, the kitchen fireplace was the social center of 90% of the American homes. That's the idea behind Typhoon's interior. The galley is the important thing. Jack also said that everyone on the ship is going to crowd into the galley and offer suggestions anyhow, and you might as well make it accessible and comfortable, and that is just what we've done. The shipmate range, the second size by the way, is right aft where the motion is the least and within easy reach of the cockpit, and the table, sink, food lockers and plate racks are arranged alongside. Except for the toilet room and a hanging locker, the rest of the cabin is open and in full view of the galley stove. Some super sensitive people may feel that such an arrangement isn't refined. Possibly not, but I know from experience that Typhoon's interior will be comfortable, and that is the first consideration. American yachting is suffering from an overdose of refinement. There is a type of prosperous yachtsman who will go to elaborate lengths and fabulous expense to finish a room in his country home to look like a regular ship, and then turn around and disguise his yacht until it looks like the boudoir of the Sultan's favourite. Typhoon is a ship designed to take anything that comes, comfortably and without a whimper, and beyond that, we have not tried to go. Her finish will be plain. She'll look like a ship below decks, and she'll smell of tar and probably of cooking, with possibly just a suggestion of fuel oil and Saint-Pierre rum. And we won't have to apologise to a hobnailed fisherman or to Sir Thomas himself if he chooses to come aboard. If Typhoon had been beamier, we might have had built-in bunks on both sides, but as it was, we chose an unsymmetrical arrangement with two built-in berths to starboard and two swing-up pipe berths to port. This gives us more foot room and a couple of sizeable seats besides. At the foot of the companionway to starboard, there is a large hanging locker for oilskins and boots, and you will notice several sets of hooks on the bulkheads for clothes, which will be kept in place by a strap, as indicated on the drawing. On the bulkhead forward, there will be bookshelves, a Chelsea luminous dial clock and a barograph. Just after the toilet room, you will notice a dresser with large drawers for personal effects, and the space beneath the bunks and transoms will accommodate the canned goods. On the starboard side, between the seat and the hanging locker, there is a novel chart case to hold charts vertically, folded once. It's Baldwin's idea, but I'm as proud of it as if it were mine. The charts will be arranged in groups, each group in its own cardboard folder, easily accessible, and when one is wanted, it can be pulled out and spread on the table, the drop leaf of which folds down against the front of the cabinet when not in use. Plumbing consists of a knockabout closet, corner porcelain lavatory, porcelain sink, and pumps for both the galley and toilet room. A 200-gallon water tank will be built in to fit the bilge space beneath the floor. Now, a word about the motor. This was decided only after endless discussion. Had we used gasoline, there were several corking good engines available, but the idea of using fuel oil appealed very strongly because of the novelty and also because of the almost prohibitive cost of gasoline in some of the places we are likely to visit. These considerations finally decided us, and we chose a new heavy oil motor. This is a two-stroke, high-compression machine, depending on the heat of compression for ignition. The fuel is injected through 15% of the stroke and burns at almost constant pressure, as in a diesel. The motor is started by compressed air, and to take the place of what heat of compression would be radiated to the cold cylinder when starting, a piece of punk is inserted by means of a steel plug with bayonet lock. It was the intention to use the smaller of the two-cylinder models, which is rated at 15 horsepower, but due to the difficulty of obtaining this size in time, we decided finally to take the single-cylinder 7.5-horsepower model. This, of course, is a mighty small power for such a husky boat, but we figure that it should give us somewhere around 5 knots in light weather, and just think of the cruising radius. The motor uses only slightly over 0.5 pound of oil per horsepower per hour, and this means that we burn about 0.5 gallon an hour. With the 170 gallons in our two permanent tanks alone, we could run for 340 hours, which, if we actually did 5 knots, would take us from Newfoundland to Queenstown. Of course, we shall have no occasion to run for more than a day or two at a time under power, but it is comforting to know that we actually could get somewhere with the motor alone, even if it did take a while. The motor is equipped with a Navy reverse gear, a McCord mechanical oiler, and a Collador strainer. The inside stuffing box, stern bearing and propeller are Colombian, the latter a two-blade 24-inch diameter by 18-inch pitch. Getting the tanks in time was a problem, but L.O. Covenant Brothers did a quick job for us and turned out the two main tanks and two smaller tanks for lubricating oil and kerosene in a week. The smaller ones are equipped with gauge glasses in the ends so that we can keep tabs on our kerosene and cylinder oil. Atkin suggested the Debevoise company's paint for the job, having had considerable experience with it in past years, and we are using it throughout. Yacht black for the top sides, white for the cabin trunk, buff for the decks, red anti-fouling for the bottom, and their special red lead for the construction in general. For the deck seams, for applying the canvas to the trunk, and for all watertight joints, we are using Nupro Marine Glue. Although the risk of fire is not great with crude oil fuel, we are still carrying two Pyrene firefighting guns. Without going into the endless details of Typhoon's construction, I must say that her white oak ribs are 3x3, spaced a little over 13 inches centre to centre, with sawed ones on the stations and bent ones between, made up double, one part bent inside the other. The planking is of yellow pine, 1¾ inches thick, and the backbone is fine, clear white oak. Note, this chapter was written in March 1920, while Typhoon was under construction. Although most of the features of her design have been justified in the light of actual experience, other things would be changed were we to build another boat for the same purpose. Of these, we shall tell later on. Chapter 2. Typhoon Goes Overboard. Bedeck, Nova Scotia, July 5th, 1920. On the 3rd of July, just 2 days later after the date we had hoped would mark her hopping off for foreign parts, Typhoon was launched. Early in March, when the keel was laid, we figured that she would be overboard about the middle of June, and this would have been the case had it not been for a belated epidemic of the flu, which swept the shop clean and set back the schedule by a fortnight. The delay cuts down our time factor of safe alarmingly, and means if we are to reach Cowes, England, in time for the Harmsworth Trophy races on the 10th of August, we'll not only have to cut out such alluring prospects as a party at the Royal Cork Yacht Club, and possibly even the very important call at Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, but also that we shall have to drive her for all she's worth across those intervening 2,000-odd miles of North Atlantic. But we are going to do it, if it is at all physically possible. Many things remain yet to be done on the ship, and further to complicate the matter of getting away, all the navies of the world seem bent on descending simultaneously on Ben Brea for demonstrations of the HD4. It looks as if either Baldwin or Sydney Breeze will have to remain behind to do the honours to these visiting delegations, and Harry Greening is so busy whipping his new Fisher Trophy Challenger into shape that he too will have to be counted out. We should have a crew of four all told, although three could do it in a pinch, but who the rest of the crew will be, God only knows. But to get back to the launching, never was there a prettier one, as the bottle of rye flew into 1,000 sparkling splinters against her stem with a determination that suggested Mrs. Baldwin's prowess with a racket. Typhoon started majestically down the ways. Gaining impetus as she went, she slid into the water on her broad stern, left her cradle behind, and floated serenely out into the lake, her shining black sides, red boot top, white deck house, buff decks fairly singing in the sunlight. It was inspiring, and it drew a shout from the little knot of workmen and visitors who had gathered in the shop to witness the ceremony. Then, taken in tow by the Dundee, she was brought alongside the wharf, where a reception was held in which our specially prepared water breaker played a prominent part. It was a great relief to see her afloat. When I arrived at Ben Brea 19 days ago, it looked as if the game was up. The hull was practically completed except for the cabin top, but the caulking had not been finished, and it seemed as if the work of jacking and smoothing the hull, paying the seams and painting alone would take a month. Then there were such things as chain plates to cut and shape from the Tobin bronze stock, the rudder to make with its special bronze fittings, the plumbing to finish, the standing rigging to cut, splice and serve, and each day seemed to make but a terribly small hole in the vast total of things to be done. But as we slid down the ways, Typhoon and I, we seemed to leave behind us that sense of the impossibility of the thing, and once afloat, sailing for England in a week seemed well within the realm of rational things. So carefully had Aitken made his calculations that the ship floated perfectly, several inches above her load waterline, and, joy of joys, slightly up by the head. I had feared that these fine waterlines and forward sections, and her consequently light displacement at this point, might bring her down too low due to her exceptionally heavy construction. But this was not the case, in spite of the fact that some ballast already had been placed pretty well forward beneath the water tank. Allowing for the masts and the 3 tons or so of additional ballast, she carries only 3,000 pounds in her lead shoe, and her equipment of gear and stores, there still seemed no danger of pulling her down too much below her designed load waterline. Today, both her sticks were stepped, their beautiful proportions and saucy rake adding materially to the already trim appearance of the boat. Typhoon looked quite lofty until the bully old battering ram of a bowsprit was housed, which carries out the line of the sheer and puts the finishing touch to a picture of concentrated power. The standing rigging, too, is quite in keeping with the sticks. Old George McKay, erstwhile square rigger, who did the splicing and serving of the shrouds, pennants, bridles and stays, never seen the like of that wire for toughness in all his seagoing days. The exhaust line and fuel and water piping of the engine are now complete, and the power plant, while not large, has the reassuring air of being able to plug along till the crack of doom. The crude oil and lubricating oil are waiting on the dock, and in a day or so we shall have a chance to see whether a crude oil engine actually will run. The installation of the exhaust line was a problem. Atkins' plan of running a pipe clean through the boat from side to side would have been all right if a hump had been worked into the line connecting it with the muffler to prevent water backing up, but since the exhaust would always be from the weather side, when the boat was heeled under sail and consequently would blow directly across the cockpit, we decided to abandon it. The usual method of running the line out the stern undoubtedly is the neatest, but there is the ever-present possibility of taking in water when running before a sea, and for this reason, we decided to run the pipe right out the side deck abaft the cockpit. A 2-foot length of 3-inch brass pipe on a swinging elbow makes it possible to shoot the gas out of the way no matter where the wind is, and furthermore, the chance of taking water into the motor is eliminated. We figure that we shall have to use the motor whenever there is insufficient wind to drive us more than about 4 or 4.5 knots, and in light weather, of course, we shall run it continuously. But in this country, which the good Lord must have designed for sailormen, there always seems to be a spanking breeze, and most of the time from the southwest. Outside, the conditions should be much the same, and unless we strike a run of bad luck, the passage should be a quick one. Tomorrow, the sails are to be bent on. Besides the 3 working sails, we are taking a square sail for running straight before it in heavy weather, and a storm jib to be set flying to an eye bolt in the stemhead, obviating the necessity of working out on the bowsprit. With the instincts of a true racing man, Casey is strong for a spinnaker. It is really not a bad idea, for all this time of year there should be plenty of moderate weather, and so we are carrying a spare one off the scrapper. We are not taking a trysail, for we figure that there are sufficient combinations of sail for heavy weather without it, and besides, it's a nuisance to set one. If it really gets that bad, we'll put out the sea anchor and call it a day. The sea anchor is a modification of the Voss type, a big canvas bag. The mouth is 6 foot square, and there is a 1 foot opening in the apex. The hull is heavily bolt roped. To make this surefire, we have worked out a sort of bullnose fitting for the end of the bowsprit, through which to lead the rope, and with this 7 foot extra leverage afforded by the stick, there should be no difficulty in holding her head into it. Before getting off the subject of sails, I would like to take this opportunity to thank old Jack Hanna for what looks to be a mightily good suggestion for holding the outboard end of the club of the jib. Instead of the short club, which he feels will eventually tear the sails, or the traveller frequently seen on working schooners, he suggests a gooseneck fitting for the end of the club, well out at the end of the bowsprit, and a loose lacing and an outhaul for the foot of the jib, which allows it to be properly trimmed and permits it to be completely lowered, an impossibility with a full-length club and a tight lacing. I sent Jack Hanna's sketch on it to Baldwin some time ago, and he thought so much of it that he immediately had the fitting made up in bronze. Well, that wasn't too bad, was it? I really enjoyed reading that book, and it only gets better and better as it's going on. It's so fantastic when you can get an author who not only has a desire to, like, hey, I'm going to tell my story, which many do, but also has a background in professional journalism and is able to really communicate what's happening, the feeling of going through the process. So that's The Track of the Typhoon by William Washburn Nutting. If you want to get hold of the rest of that recording, then it's over on patreon.com/themariner. As I said before, we don't have any sponsors or partners for this podcast, so it's essential that find some way of allowing it to move into the future. Patreon is a perfect way of being able to do that. That's $5 a month. If you want to get access to more of the videos, more of the content, then that's $20 a month. We've got lots going on in the next couple of months with that. I've had a very interesting approach about doing an expedition, which is going to take me across the Atlantic on an expedition, like going and doing some scientific research, which is pretty exciting. So I've got my own opportunity to go back across the Atlantic in The Track of the Typhoon coming very, very soon. And I'll be including all the preparations for that and giving you the details of what that expedition's about over on Patreon. But as I say, I'm going to get John to come in and talk to us about what the Attainable Adventure Cruising website Peeps and himself and Phyllis came up with as the best possible boat. I was interviewed recently by Paul Trammell, who has the excellent Sailing and Cruising podcast. Another copy of that interview, you can get it on Paul's podcast, of course, or it's over on Patreon as well. But I'm going to be sort of turning the tables and interviewing Paul and finding out in his experience, because he's actually living on a boat, traveling on a boat, what he finds to be the best elements of his boat and what he would change, what he'd like to do. If you have any input on this, what kind of things you really look for in a boat, what it is that really turns you off or on with a boat. We all know what it is to look at YBW.com or whatever website you look at to get your brokerage information and sit and dream and wonder. I'm kind of like a high latitudes person when I look at those things, or I'm looking for the kind of boats I own, which is boats that can go through the Southern Ocean. So I'm quite an extreme person in terms of where I'm asking a boat to go. I'm not really that knowledgeable on what's the best things to get going into the Caribbean, like catamaran or something small and cheap that's shallow draft. You can get up into the mangroves if you need to hang out away from a hurricane. Not sure. Be interested to hear what's your top three things that you need to have in a boat for it to be considered your perfect boat. But I hope you enjoyed that one. Just a quick one today in Friday, the 20th of January. I hope that you're enjoying winter as it's coming on here. We've had our first dump of snow and the electricity is literally starting to flicker. So I'm going to bring this quite quickly to a close and get this out so that you have something to listen to going into the weekend. But I'll be back on Monday with more Mariner Podcast. So until then, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound. And I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.